disperse immediately or you will be subject to arrest. Do it now.
A boss ain't nothing but a thief on a time loan. 128 bit war, you play Nintendo. On some shooter, so put the bridge down and feed us to the killer bees. We get what we deserve, life. Bury me with my MP3s. Write my manifesto in 72 DPI. Life's just a game, you got cheated, never learn. I write these songs every bridge that ain't been burned. For every cop car that ain't.
Welcome to This Is America, June 4th, 2019. This episode, we talk with Sima Lee, an anarchist organizer and MC in the Washington, D.C. area. In our interview, we talk about the current Don't Mute D.C. movement, as well as gentrification and the history of go-go music, which lay at the center of it. We then talk about the ongoing community organizing work that is happening at the Maroon House, organized by the Food, Clothing, and Resistance Collective, or FCRC, which currently includes a free store and a growing food program. We end by talking about the potential of these types of mutual aid programs and how they can possibly continue to grow and spread. Maroon House currently is hosting a fundraiser to cover their costs, and we highly encourage people to donate. You can see a link linked in our show notes. All this and more, but first, let's get to the news. In El Paso, Texas, at the same detention facility we have talked about in the past, where photos of children and adults sleeping outside with nothing but thin metal blankets have gone viral, a Homeland Security inspector found the detention facility was imprisoning hundreds more than it is designed to. According to news reports, some migrants have been held in standing room only spaces for days and weeks. As ABC News wrote, the El Paso Del Norte Processing Center housed as many as 900 migrant detainees earlier this month, and the report also found the facility only has the capacity for 125. They said Border Patrol was struggling to maintain hygienic conditions in the holding cells, with limited access to showers and clean clothing. Detainees were wearing soiled clothing for days and weeks. On Monday, Customs and Border Protection announced two more deaths in their custody. As Democracy Now! wrote, a 40-year-old Honduran woman died Monday morning. She collapsed just 25 minutes after being detained near the border in Eagle Pass, Texas, but could not be saved by emergency medical treatment. Customs and Border Protection also said Monday a 33-year-old Salvadorian man died after experiencing apparent seizures following his apprehension on Sunday. According to GayStar News, a transgender asylum seeker, Johanna Medina, a refugee from El Salvador, sadly died in ICE custody on June 1st, the first day of Pride Month. The website Planet Transgender reports that Medina is the 23rd transgendered person to die in ICE custody. Combined, this makes for a total of 3 deaths in just 3 days. As Democracy Now! noted, in addition to the recent deaths, at least 6 migrant children have died over the past 8 months after they were arrested crossing into the U.S. from Mexico. Before last year, no child died in immigration custody in over a decade. Flooding continues across the Midwest and the Great Plains as levees, dams, and other aging infrastructure continues to break down in the face of unprecedented storms and rising waters. Just this week, a new study on climate change out of Australia concluded the human civilization itself is threatened with collapse by 2050 if drastic action is not taken to stop climate change. A new study from BuzzFeed on the social media posting habits of police officers has now been published. A large amount of the posts celebrated violence against protesters, as well as women, people of color, and migrants. As the report shows, quote, of the pages of officers whom researchers could possibly identify, about 1 in 5 of the current officers and 2 in 5 of retired officers made public posts or comments that met the threshold, typically by displaying bias, applauding violence, scoffing at due process, or dehumanizing language. Of 328 officers in just Philadelphia who posted troubling content, more than one-third, 139 officers, appeared to have one or more federal civil lawsuits filed against them based on name, badge number, and other corroborating details. Of that group, 100 ended up in settlements or verdicts against them or the city. In Brooklyn, New York, 2 speaking events featuring Holocaust deniers were shut down after community pressure was applied. At Portland State University, a fascist troll and former underling of Milo Yiannopoulos in Baked Alaska, Mike Mahoney, was milkshaked before he could give a a talk in front of the local college Republicans. In Idaho, according to Unicorn Riot, several people rallied outside of an IHOP where a local Republican group had been scheduled to host a speech by white supremacist pundit Brittany Pettibone. A rally against Pettibone's appearance was organized after concerned locals learned she was coming, and then the GOP civic group swiftly canceled the event while the protests continued outside. In Brooklyn, banners were dropped in memory of Erica Garner and her father, Eric Garner. In Salt Lake City, Utah, people crashed corporate pride with banners and speeches, while in Buffalo, New York, people marched as a block in the Pride Parade, carrying banners against white supremacy, gentrification, and police. Meanwhile, Confederate monuments in Austin, Texas were vandalized with paint and written slogans such as racist, and in Northern California, about half of the inmates at a fire camp or a low security unit where inmates who volunteer to work as firefighters live but are also paid nothing for their work rioted, according to a local news site. Lastly, despite attempts by police and pipeline crews to remove them earlier last week, the Yellowfinch tree sit continues, now its 273rd day of fighting the Mountain Valley Pipeline. If you're looking to show solidarity with people in trouble and help some projects get off the ground, members of the Fang Collective are starting to fundraise to help a friend who is starting a jail stint for taking action in solidarity with migrant detainees who are on hunger strike. If you can't make it to a Run Down the Walls event, you can support online groups like the Anarchist Black Cross. A queer and trans feminist space in Mexico City unfortunately was attacked along with its volunteers, and they are looking for some help to get back on their feet. And lastly, anti-fascist researcher Spencer Sunshine was published numerous pieces on It's Going Down is launching a Patreon. You can support all these projects and people by going to our show notes and checking the links. And now, here's some upcoming events. In June, be on the lookout for Running Down the Walls events happening across the world to benefit the Anarchist Black Cross and other prison abolitionist groups. On June 6th in Portland, join pickets in solidarity with the Burgerville Workers Union as they fight for a contract 1 year after negotiations have started. On June 12th, there is an info night in solidarity with Indonesian anarchists in Minneapolis. On June 12th and through 19th, there is the Save the Matol Direct Action Convergence in Northern California. On June 14th through the 17th, there is the Fight Toxic Prisons Conference in Gainesville, Florida. On June 15th through the 23rd, there is the Wild Roots Feral Futures Gathering in Southwest Colorado. On June 19th, there is a Mobilization Against the White Nationalist National Solutions Conference in Burns, Tennessee. On June 29th through the 30th, check out the Southern Regional Organizing Assembly of the Industrial Workers of the World in Richmond, Virginia. On June 3rd through the 11th, go to the Institute for Advanced Troublemaking in Worcester, Massachusetts. And finally, on August 16th through the 18th, check out the Indigenous Anarchist Convergence in so-called Flagstaff, Arizona. That's going to do it for us today. As always, enjoy the interview and the discussion, and we will see you soon.
Cross the border, 1984. Tape recorder, slaughter. Sony Walkman order. Still can't drink the water. Sorta serious, like Cool C and Steady B before the murder case. Teachers start with decimals. We never learned our place. Love's gone, new era dawn, and all the thugs gone. But funny how the heroin's back. Look where the drugs gone. People see my facial expression, they be like, what's wrong? Need to pull a Jonathan Jackson until the judge gone. A pleasure principle, principal pleasure. It's putting pressure on the system with machetes tucking the dresses. Never lesser, fresher since an embryo or an indigo. Slave revolts where rivers flow. Take over your riverboat. Simmers though, a simple quote. Straight up like strippers go. Since one scream, here we go. Lee jeans and stripper bows. My rhymes be sicker, bro. Like a sip of fifth of Irish rose. Wild style, arrow soldier, Irish. Sometimes I rhyme slow. Sometimes I rhyme quick. Sometimes I burn sage. Sometimes my nine spit. Sometimes I stay at home. I'm tired of nonsense. Don't trust that po-po anytime. Got calm sense. Sometimes I rhyme slow, sometimes I rhyme quick. Sometimes I burn sage, sometimes my nine spit. Sometimes I stay at home, I'm tired of nonsense. Don't trust that government anytime, got calm sense. This be that Butterfinger crunch, brown and tan. MCM's for Dapper Dan. I'll be sure, buttons on the jackets and in effect mode, death cold as she's stalking us. If you got melanin, many men be talking us. Ain't no stopping us, Miss Batten and White. I got a special brand of fresh daddy on my patent, it's tight. Rapidly bright, see my black skin, bring up the light. Genius of love, Tauntaun Club, bring it tonight. Play me some dub, vampires still bringing the bite. Bring me some love, never enough for these bars to recite. My bars hard like peppermint bark, but simply being women walking down the street and taking steps in the park. Respect them, excellence par, little dude is too. Not in the club with mad soul, but he do be crew. This dead critical, VA, pre-83, Whitaker, sweet pea, two finger rings, throwing up peace. Sometimes I rhyme slow, sometimes I rhyme quick. Sometimes I burn sage, sometimes my nine spit. Sometimes I stay at home, I'm tired of nonsense. Don't trust that po-po anytime, got calm sense. Sometimes I rhyme slow, sometimes I rhyme quick. Sometimes I burn sage, sometimes my nine spit. Sometimes I stay at home, I'm tired of nonsense. Don't trust that government anytime, got calm sense. This my baby boy. My baby boy, ha. I see you, Masu. 2399. I love you. Naeem too. Simile. RBG.
I'm Simile, the RBG. I'm a community organizer and founder of Food Clothing Resistance Collective and Maroon House in Washington, D.C. I'm an artist, MC, a spoken word poet, and an anarchist.
Awesome. And then can you just tell us the title of your last album? I mean, really encourage people to check it out if they haven't heard it before. And also check out the interview you did with the Soulcast. It's really worth listening to.
Awesome. Yes. My last album that I released was an EP entitled Trap Liberation Army. And it was an homage to a kid like me who grew up being influenced by the trap, as well as organizations like Black Liberation Army, Black Panther Party, AIM, Young Lords, Weather Underground. It's kind of mixing my backgrounds together, you know, as an MC. And it's available right now on Bandcamp. Check that out. S-I-M-A-L-E-E. Bandcamp.com. Check out Simile. I think the rebels out there will really enjoy it. It's kind of like some Dead Prez meets Public Enemy meets Wu-Tang meets Cypress Hill.
Yeah. It's good stuff.
Word.
You know, when a lot of people think about D.C., of course, they think about the White House and various monuments. But, I mean, you know, if you haven't been there and you haven't really seen just where how most people live, I think it's really something that people need to understand about the context there. Can you just kind of break down the racial and the class dynamics of the city?
Well, right now it's really tense, to be honest. I'm not speaking as a native Washingtonian. I'm speaking as a Black native. But I'm from originally from Norfolk, Virginia Beach area, and I've been back and forth in Washington, D.C. since the 90s, just living and surviving and moving back out of town and coming back. I've been here roughly the last 8 years, right around the end of Occupy Movement, Occupy D.C. And just in these last 10 years, the gentrification is outrageous. We're losing a lot of people from the area who have been here their whole lives. The rents are doubling and tripling. It's very tense. There's culture clashes that are going on for people who are just moving here to Washington, D.C., more affluent bourgeoisie type folks who don't really care about the history or the culture of the Black and brown people who have been here for so long. And there are tensions. Recently, there's a movement that popped up called Don't Mute D.C., and it's basically been a movement through the go-go music, which is, you know, the music of D.C., created in the hood from nothing, you know. And they've been using it to resist because people have complained about, you know, a store that used to play music every day on the loudspeaker. It's something that if you're from the area, you're used to this. This is the culture. This is beautiful. It's nice to hear. But people who have, you know, moved to the area who are not from there, basically shut it down. And within 24 hours, I haven't seen protests this big in a very long time.
Yeah.
For D.C. related issues and people who are not from here, you really need to check out the Don't Mute D.C. Movement, because it started as turn off your music. We don't want to hear that. It went from that to, well, let's talk about the gentrification. Let's talk about the hospitals that are getting closed. Let's talk about our lack of access to, enough grocery stores. things are very different. There are two DCs. There is the affluent political DC and the rich people and Georgetown University and, you know, AU and all these other places. And then there's everyone else who's just trying to survive and make it in one of the most rapidly gentrifying areas in the entire country, where you can get a one bedroom from like for like $1,500 and up. It's awful. And a lot of people don't get that when they come and they f*** it up. Yeah, f*** it up. I always tell people that, but you need to talk to the people who are from here and see what they're dealing with, what's going on. A lot of police containment, stop and frisk is here. I know it was highlighted really highly about New York, but in Washington, D.C., we have what is known as jump outs. And basically, they jump out of the vehicles and they stop and frisk you. Constant harassment. We've had clashes last summer. It was very hot. It was very tense. A councilman warned people this year that may happen again because the people are tired of being beaten and harassed and searched and by the police. And they're upset with the councilman for saying those things, the FOP and others. But this is what it is. Like, people are tired. Black people are losing their homes, their schools, their jobs, and the police are everywhere. Not making things safer, but just being pigs. So it's very tense in D.C. And on top of that, Donald Trump is the f***ing president. Like, yeah man, is real.
Yeah, the Don't Mute D.C. protests, we talked a little bit about them on this program a couple episodes back, but there were some really amazing pictures of people on, like, quads and stuff like that. But yeah, thousands of people out in the streets, and it was... Our understanding is that the demand to get the music back on at the store, that happened pretty quickly on because there was just such an outpouring, but then it just continued on just thousands of people out. Like you were saying, there were like big block parties. And
they just had one for Memorial Day. They had one in Freedom Plaza. And, you know, if you were here for Occupy DC, you know, that was one of the stomping grounds for, you know, a lot of socialists, anarchists, communists, just badass radicals, you know, meeting together and figure out what, you know, what we're going to do, you know, in the Obama era. Ha ha hee hee. the Obama fascist era. But now in the Trump fascist era, you know, the music is springing up, and it's not just music. I need people to understand culture is a very big part of the revolution, and it keeps the spirits of the masses up. And Go-Go has a lot to say. Even back in the day, Junkyard Band had this song about the word, you know, and it was talking about Reagan and the food stamps getting cut off and the farmers don't have anything to farm. So I guess the farmers are going to farm mud. Like, this was 1985 when they made this song, and they were talking that real stuff then. The farmers are still going to have to farm mud, either that or GMOs. And now Trump's cutting the food stamps. Like, this music is spurring people to address other things that are going on in the community. Like I said, the schools are crap. We have lead-filled water, one of the worst rates in the nation. The police are out of control. We don't even have state rights in Washington, D.C. So we don't even really have a vote or a say-so. And it's tense. It's all of these things are going on at the same time. And it's just a very tense time right now to live here and to be an organizer, especially.
What was the name of that group you just mentioned?
The Junkyard Band. They're one of, like, considered one of the founders or the early, you know, four groups of Go-Go. And they were signed early on by Def Jam, which is huge.
Oh, really?
Yeah. They toured with Run DMC, and if I'm not mistaken, they were in one of Run DMC's, like, earliest movies. I mean, of course, now that doesn't mean anything to a lot of people, but if you're, like, hip-hop music aficionado, like, that was huge. They came from Berry Farms Projects, which right now is getting torn down, you know? It's all going full circle, so I guess that's why people feel so, you know, protective about their music right now. Where the music was formed is even getting torn down. Like, that's where we are in D.C. I believe over 20,000 black people displaced. They're gone. We are no more Chocolate City. It's gentrification city.
Where are people getting pushed to? Just suburbs outside of D.C. or...
Well, PG County, Maryland. Some people are in different parts of Maryland, Hyattsville, maybe Montgomery County, Maryland, or just completely, they're just gone. You know, they just went somewhere completely. But if they're going to stay on the side and try to be still near D.C., a lot of them went to PG County and Hyattsville and possibly Baltimore.
Is that where people are going if they're still trying to get into D.C. to work?
Yeah, because you don't want to go, you know, you don't want to go so far with the volatility of economics. Like, you don't know when the rent's going to go up. You don't know when they're going to hike the, you know, metro fees. So people are trying to still stay near D.C. You know, they call this the DMV. D.C. people are really particular, though. Like, they're from D.C., you know. People will call Maryland the D.C. metro, but they get a little offended sometimes. You know, Northern Virginia is Northern Virginia. D.C. is D.C. Maryland is Maryland. And, you know, me being from Virginia and from southeastern Virginia, not even from this region, I'm always aware of that, you know, respecting people's cultural identities and not erasing them in the region, you know.
Yeah. And that push to just, you know, push people out into the suburbs, I mean, that just breaks people up from neighborhoods, you know, keeps them really isolated, and everybody has different schedules because of work, and you're just drained every day because you're traveling so much to just go to your crappy job and then come home.
So that's what we have. We have people either not getting paid enough right here, because on average, people are not even making $15. And I'm telling you, if it's $1,500 for a one bedroom, you can only imagine. So you're going to go, you can get the money, but it might, like you said, it might drain you. So if people are wondering, well, why aren't people rebelling in D.C.? People are just trying to eat. I know people noticed when the federal workers weren't getting paid, because those are more affluent jobs. But, you know, a lot of people are barely making it without that, which is why we have an organization like we have, just to feed and clothe people. That's like the most simple, basic thing that you can do, but it's very political. And we get that from the Panthers, who were right here in Washington, D.C. They had a Northwestern chapter, and they did the same thing. Feeding people and clothing people was a major part of what they did, in addition to the political education.
Yeah, well, that's a great transition to our next question. So just tell us about how the Maroon House, the FCRC, you know, formed, and, you know, about the work that you mentioned that it does.
Well, Food Clothing Resistance Collective came first. Just to give a bit of the background, I've been a community organizer, a teacher, artist in some way, shape or form since the 90s. I guess I'm aging myself. But anyway, basically, I would say around 2011, 2012, I came from my area of Virginia, like I said, Norfolk, Virginia Beach area, and I came to D.C. for the anniversary of Occupy D.C. I was down with Occupy Norfolk slightly, but more so Occupy the Hood, which was black and brown led, and met up with some comrades, anarchists and socialists, in this house called the Peace House, which was connected to the longest running anti-nuclear vigil in the nation. It's directly across from the White House. There's a tent. If you've ever been a protester and you've been out there, you've seen that tent, you've seen the signs, you've had interesting conversations, whether it was Connie, who was featured in Michael Moore's film, or Filippos, longtime anarchist badass from Cali. Just really badass people, and we connected, and for the first time I felt like I had a home with other anarchist comrades and socialist comrades, who were not just talking a bunch of book talk, but we were living this work of mutual aid and direct action and really kicking fascist ass before it became cool. And so while I was at the I mean, you know, it you know, it has its ups and downs of being sexy. Right now, I guess it's sexy. It's the sexy thing to do. But, you know, when you don't get pressed for it and you just getting ass kicked or getting your ass kicked, that shit ain't sexy. But yeah, so Peace House is really dope place. Lots of events, people coming together from all across the country. Just a really communal living. And it just felt good. I was raised in several communities like that back at home in the Hampton Roads area. So it felt good. The difference was that it was more diverse. I'm used to a lot of black and brown gatherings, and this was more just a little bit of everybody, and it was still cool, but it was interesting to meet crust punks, not necessarily my background, but, you know, hey, if they were down for the system, and they were, you know, it was a cool thing. So from there, I started Food Clothing Resistance Collective while I was at the Peace House. And it was just a way for us to take all the great programs of mutual aid that we had internally in the house and collaborate with other comrades and to take it to the streets as far as tent cities, you know, bringing toiletries and food to tent cities, to places here like Franklin Park. When the riots happened or the uprising happened, when Trump got inaugurated, we had just serviced that park maybe a couple of days before then, feeding the, you know, the houseless community that was there. And that's just regular work that a lot of people do in that park is just feed people and get them clothing and toiletries. So stuff like that became just an everyday mission once we realized how many people were food insecure. Like so many. It just, it boggled the mind. And that's one of the first things I noticed when I got here, how many homeless people there were, or just large amounts. And it just was very frustrating to see all over the place, but especially near the White House, and how it just seemed like people would walk by and not care. So we made that our focus. When Maroon House was born a year ago, when Peace House moved to another location and I took over full time running this space in Northeast DC, and it became more of a reflection of black queer women. So then now the house is 8 black queer women running the programs, having events, opening our doors, feeding people. We have a people's pantry, a free store, if you will, which is a continuation of the program that we did at the Peace House, but we expanded it into a pantry. And we bring it out to the front of our house, and we serve people right from the front of our house. So we get to talk to our neighbors. We get to hear what issues are going on in the community. We allow people to have free meetings and classes. And we rent space as far as for events so that we can, you know, fundraise and be as self-sufficient as possible. And it's been a really interesting ride, meeting so many different organizers through the space. I don't know of many spaces like ours as far as we have a wide variety of people, even though it's 8 black queer women, a wide variety of people come through the space, and we keep people centered on anti-colonial work because we are 8 black queer women. We are going to keep the focus on decolonization, on, you know, what does that mean beyond terms? Like, what does that look like? What does it look like to have liberated land? What does it look like to have reparations? What does it look like to actually take care of each other outside of these damn marches and the ideology that we spew? How do we treat each other? Do you have a sandwich? Do you have a coat? Comrade, I see you have holes in your shoes. We lose all of that. We lose that trying to quote Marx and Emma Goldman and Malcolm X and Asada. We lose those things, not being human and humane to each other. So that's what this house is for, to collaborate and just to get people back together. It's been working. The ideas that have sprung forth and the reaction from the community has been very positive.
How do you all coordinate gathering all the clothing? Because, I mean, in the photos of the project, you can see, like you said, it's like a free store. It's really impressive. Like, people can walk in and get stuff, and then, you said, you put the food out in the front. How do you coordinate getting the clothes and then also the food for the program?
Yeah, it's good old-fashioned. It comes from the textbook, literally, and you can download this handbook. A lot of people don't know the survival programs of the Black Panther Party are actually online. If you look hard enough, you can find it, and it shows you kind of a blueprint of the survival programs and community programs that they had. And again, my background is from that. I grew up in a community where it was nothing but just a bunch of radicals who were still active in the movement and were just trying to, you know, give us pointers of what to do. So I still keep a lot of that to this day. And it's just good old fashioned asking people to drop off what they don't need. And you would think in a greedy city like DC that that wouldn't happen. But in fact, it's starting to spread and we're starting to see more and more groups doing this. It's a lot of work, though. It's a constantly having to ask, can you drop off food? Can you drop off clothing? Can you drop off toiletries? Would you like to make a cash donation? There, again, I say sexy. It's nothing sexy about that. It's not shiny. It's not pretty. But it's good old-fashioned grassroots, you know, organizing. And it keeps me, you know, focused on what is important. Because I used to go to a lot of protests. I used to go to a lot of, you know, a lot of things that activists go to, speeches and... But I would notice people who were there who didn't even have a place to stay after the protest, and they would come and crash at the Peace House or they would come and crash at Maroon House. And it started to get frustrating that we weren't taking care of each other. So asking other people, could you leave some things for others who don't have, especially for those who are out here who are working poor and, you know, doing the best that they can and just to pay the rent and may not have enough for food. And that's a reality in Washington, D.C. I don't think people get that. Asking, you know, some people don't like to ask. I have no problem asking. I've had federal workers even come and get food. It's that serious. And we need more help. I mean, I feel like I don't do enough. We need more food, more clothing. It's about to be summertime and people pass out right in front of our streets. There's obviously a drug epidemic, K2, PCP, of course, opioids. We have to make sure that people have water and we have a couple of doses of Narcan on hand. But a lot of times it's not drug overdoses that we're seeing. It's just people passing out from heat stroke and things of this nature. So some of us know first aid. Some of us are street medics. And this is just a part of what we do. If we're going to be in the neighborhood, to not gentrify and to not take from, you have to give back and service and, you know, your community. So asking people for food and clothes for other people, I can do that all day. So that's pretty much what we do.
What's the response been from people?
It's been amazing. We've had, I don't know, like I can't even, sometimes it's hard for me to wrap my head around it. It's this one picture that motivates me. And it's this picture of Bobby Seale standing outside in Cali, I believe, maybe Oakland. It's while he's running for mayor, if I'm not mistaken. And 50,000 bags of groceries or something like that, some humongous number of groceries. They were all filled up. They all had a whole chicken. Sorry, vegans. But this was the 60s. and that was a big deal to have a whole chicken, you know, in your bag along with a full bag of groceries. And that I've been chasing that picture for so many years. Like, I would love to do that. We haven't come quite as close as that, but we have had Capital Food Bank back their truck up and deliver food to us right in front of our home, and we distribute it. And when I say it went in a day, we're talking pallets and pallets of food in a day. About 80 to 90% of that food was gone. People were calling other people. People were helping people. It was amazing. The response has been incredible. When we put the clothing out, by the end of the day, the clothes are gone. The food is gone. And it's not people hoarding it. Sometimes it's the same faces. Sometimes it's completely different faces each time. And people often feel a sense of not wanting to. And we have to let them know, hey, this isn't a shame thing. You have feel no shame about this. This is free because we should be giving things back to each other. We should be recycling. People have too many damn shoes and clothes. And, you know, the stores are about to throw away food. And if you work at a store and, you know, before you even have to dumpster dive, you know, you can liberate those things or just get them with permission, you know, right from the general manager to pick up and give to people. We're not saying liberate it as far as steal it, but what I'm saying is each store has a surplus amount of things and they're going to throw it away. Mm-hmm. There are stores like Mom's Organics, though, that will give you that produce. So we have people chipping in from all over, giving us things so that we can distribute it back to the community. And the community is very appreciative of it. We had an episode with the police recently in March. It was a really messed up harassment thing that they did. And they pulled guns and things on us. Eventually they left. We weren't charged, anything like that, but it was scary. But the community was out there watching to make sure that we were okay. And so the community appreciates us. They look out for us. We look out for them. And the response, you know, we would like it to be bigger so that we can help more people, which is why we're fundraising now.
You know, I wanted to ask you when you brought up the Panthers, actually, I know a lot of people that I've met over the years that have done projects like Food Not Bomb. Sometimes they walk away from doing those things feeling like, well, this is just charity. There's no political end to this. It's just, you know, a nice thing to do to people. And I mean, other people have different experiences and they use it to organize. But I'm just curious, like, how do we use these mutual aid programs to build like a bigger, like, how does this fit into a broader movement? And it's not just
right through this, we've been able to meet people. It can't be, I drop this food off, pat myself on the back, let me go skip away to a bookstore and you know, go read a book. It has to be, you're building relationships with the community. And that's why I say this is grassroots 101, because we're out there with clipboards. We're out there with flyers. We're out there receiving information, and we're out there giving information. So if anything is going on, anything is going down, we're in the midst of it talking to the actual community that it's affecting. That's not charity work. And we can't give charity. We are 8 black queer women, you know, who are due reparations, not because that sounds good, because we are. And as a Native person, I don't even want to get on the topic. This is stolen land. You know, with stolen people walking all over Washington, D.C., or people who have been forced out of their communities. They call them immigrants. But, you know, our neighbors who are from Guatemala or from Salvador and other places, you know, they were pushed out by war that was backed by this country. And so we get to have these real conversations and not just preaching to people with words that they don't understand, jargon and all of these things. We get so sectarian that we don't even realize that people don't relate to us. This keeps you humble, and you get to hear exactly what's going on. You get to hear about a slumlord on that street, or a shooting happened on this, or the police are fucking with someone on that one. It's constantly being involved, and it's the most rewarding work outside of teaching children that I have ever done. And that's just being honest. I've punched a lot of fascists in the face. I've got arrested for it. There, you know, ass smash racism DC, they know about simile. But this work is the most rewarding, not because of the feel good moments, but because of the real conversations and the real actions we get to do after these conversations to help people. And if comrades don't do this work, understanding that, if you don't do mutual aid, understanding that, then you're going to think that it's some damn Bill Gates charity stuff. Like, you've got to be real. We're talking about overthrowing, you know, classism and white supremacy and sexism and homophobia and transphobia. But what does it look like? What does that look like after the revolution, post-revolution? What does it look like? We're going to have to talk to each other and know each other. Are we going to do that after the revolution? Or are we going to do that now and establish these strong relationships now? That's what I'm here for. I used to travel and hop over. You know, I've been to Baltimore in the middle of the shit and Ferguson and so many other things. But right here and right now is where I'm at. And there's a struggle that is serious going on in Washington, D.C. This is the nation's capital, but this is Rome, and it's crumbling, and we see it every day. This is where the hell I have to be, and this is where a lot of comrades need to be, in these damn streets, helping your community with mutual aid. This is the most direct action that you're going to get other than just outright tossing some fucking Molotov cocktails. So I'm tossing vegetables right now. that we can toss some Molotovs later, you know?
You brought up Rome crumbling. I mean, you know, you mentioned that you've been in and out of D.C. for several decades. I mean, is that really the feeling that you get? Because it seems like, from what we can see, like, if, I mean, obviously this has been happening in African-American communities, you know, for a very long time. But, I mean, like, if you look at Puerto Rico or, you know, everything with, like, this water crisis, I mean, it just seems like the state more and more just is openly just doesn't give a shit about huge areas under its supposed control.
Yeah.
I mean, does it really feel like, from what you're seeing, just like you were mentioning, just Rome crumbling?
I feel that it's crumbling because capitalism is crumbling. It's, and I don't just go off of feelings. Again, I'm an anarchist, so I'm a scientist. You know, like we're studying something, like we're getting into it and seeing where the contradictions lie. So I'm seeing stores close every day. I'm seeing massive industries failing. I'm seeing print newspapers go up. I'm seeing things that even in the 80s, when we were under Ray Gunn, as Gil Scott-Heron used to call him, some of these things weren't even happening, man. Like, factories are gone. Detroit is gone. I lived in Baltimore. 20,000 plus or so more abandoned homes just shuttered and closed. And there are other cities and states that don't get talked about that are pretty much, you know, shutting down and losing people and losing jobs, and schools are closing. Like, if that's not an indication that something isn't working, i.e. capitalism, and that is crumbling, then look at Trump's own cabinet, where every week he's firing somebody else. Nixon wasn't even this messy.
Yeah.
This is like seriously, like, past all the rhetoric and how pissed off it is, they're digging in deeper. Why do you think they're trying to ban abortion? Why do you think they're coming against trans and queer people? It's a reason, because they got to lash out. These are the last gasps of this shit, and it's our job to hasten the crumble. You know, it's really, from the outside in, it might not look like it, but from the inside out, man, this stuff is crumbling. It's falling apart. But what the problem is we don't have a collective movement. The movement is the weakest I've ever seen it. I'm going to be honest, because comrades are not being real about this. This is the weakest that the American anarchist, communist, socialist movement has been in a long time. A long time. We might think that we're out kicking some ass, but besides these isolated moments of beating up fascists, man, when it comes to building up an infrastructure to train and make sure that people have the things that we need from a domestic and internationalist level, we are not there. So despite the fact that everything is crumbling, man, these fascists and these neo-fascists, they're training. And it needs to be more of us that are training. There needs to be more people who are on the platform of privilege and have money. And that may be white people, that may be rich people of color. But if you're on a platform of privilege and you have, like, the Madea Benjamins of the world with millions, oh, I said it. You see, I'm here to talk truth. And you need to cough up that cash, comrade. You know, I'm glad that you're, you know, looking out for the comrades in Venezuela, but how often have you hold yourself up to stop Berry Farms from being shut down, or Brookland Manor right to the right of us, and all the other things that are going on to black and brown people right here in Washington, D.C.? We don't need dramatics. What we need is a real fucking revolution, and that takes butter and guns and money and all of those real, actual, tangible things. So that's how we're going to make this shit crumble, if we actually have people who invest in this revolution and not just in their own logos and personal brands. So it's frustrating for me, because I can see this shit cracking, but we as a mass, the masses, we're just not there. We're not there yet.
Well, with that in mind, looking towards the future, how do you see the project that we've been talking about growing?
Yeah, mainly because more people are coming up asking, like, how did you guys get to do this? Or where can we get food? Where can we distribute it? I'm seeing collaborations happen, you know, just from people talking to us. I've seen other groups spring up who are also feeding and clothing people. Again, it's not just to feed and clothe people. That's not the ends of it. But it's important, because people should not want. And we're hoping people will get more into giving out things. Let's give out some land. Let's give out some homes. Let's give out, like, honestly, when we say maroon house, you know, we're talking about the spirit of the maroons who escaped from slavery and created, you know, safe communities in the middle of oppression. And so our movement is to see that happen and to see that happen all over. And if people leave our space and say they're inspired, which they often do, then we're doing what we're supposed to do. And if we see more collectives pop up, whether they're farms, whether they're houses, you know, whether they're a bookshop like Red Emma's or other comrades, just, you know, really living this, then I feel like that's going to hasten capitalism's demise when we're not spending all our money with them and we're coming up with solutions, because when the insurance is gone, we still have, we're still going to get sick. And, you know, when the stores aren't open or we don't have a grocery store, we still have to find out a way. And, that's all it is. It's just doing what people have done for so long and continuing it. And I know it's going to continue beyond us. I already see other collectors popping up left and right, trying to do similar things. So, we just got to get more on this, and we have to communicate more outside of our own bubbles and our own circles. Yes, we do a lot from this house, but we go out to other people's stuff. It would be nice to see more people in the city support us. Hey, white anarchists, socialists, and communists, I'm talking to you. Come through, comrades. I mean, that's just the honest truth. I'm being honest. We can't just see you at Black Bloc, and we can't just see you, you know, at the next Peter Kropotkin Appreciation Day. Like, we need to see you all the time. And, you know, let's talk about what's really going on, and let's talk about stepping off the platform of white privilege and get your John Brown on. Let's do it. We need more John Browns out there.
Well, let's talk about the fundraiser and how people can donate and where they can go to do that.
Oh, yeah. Well, if you go to Facebook.com, that awful place, I wish I hadn't put the fundraiser up there. We may set up a GoFundMe, but on our Maroon House page on Facebook, that's M-A-R-O-O-N House, our fundraiser is up there. Help Maroon House feed the people. You can make a direct donation there. But if you don't like Facebook, and I completely understand, because it is COINTELPRO 2.0, you can make a donation at our PayPal. I think the link is paypal.me/SIMARBG, that's SIMARBG, or the email for it is at FCRcollective@gmail.com. And we also have a Cash App, $SIMALEERBG. So either way, you can also email us at maroonmovement@gmail.com. Let us know if you want to come through, drop off any food or clothing, or let us know if you want to make a cash donation and you don't want to do it digitally. You can always drop it off on us. Just email us, you know, message us. We're also on Instagram at Maroon Movement. You can just directly message us. Every bit helps. It costs us $5,000 a month to keep this space up. Gentrification is real here. It should not cost $5,000 for this house, but it does.
That's a lot.
It's ridiculous. And so that's, you know, we have to put fundraisers up from time to time, and we have to be creative. We book space. If you want to have an event in a bad spot, or we have everything from hip hop to punk to holistic healing, movie nights. I mean, we do a little bit of everything, classes, meetings, workshops. You know, hit us up, Maroon House on Facebook or at our Gmail. We're looking to build and meet with new comrades every day. It doesn't matter if you're not black and queer. Bring your asses in here and let's meet and let's do some work.
Well, anything else you want to talk about or touch on?
Oh, man. I don't know. Like, I try not to over talk because I can go. But I'm passionate about everything that I talked about, and I just want to meet more comrades who want to do this work. I don't want to walk around, you know, feeling as if, you know, we're from different parts of this or that or different orgs and different leaders. And, you know, I'm about horizontal leadership, and I'm about, you know, we're all leaders, you know, in our own way, whether we're heading up a committee or not. Like, I just want to ask people to stop being so sectarian. I need communists and anarchists and socialists and progressives. You liberals and Democrats and Republicans, but I'm talking to my people here. Like, we got to get over ourselves and get back to the roots of this work. And that's about liberating ourselves so that we can truly be free. This is still native land. Black people are still colonized beings who have been stolen. That didn't change because the date is 2019. Brown people have still been pushed out of their homes because of war. Our climate is like, it's looking grim, but what keeps us going is each other. So we have got to reach out to each other and get over ourselves. And I'm willing to meet with comrades who are serious and really want to do this work. You are invited to come to the Maroon House. As for Simile, some of y'all already know me. You know what's up. Shout out to Franklin Lopez, who retired recently. Just making last minute shout outs. That's a good comment.
Awesome.
Right on.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. I've been watching y'all and checking y'all out for a long time. So it's good to be on the program. Y'all do one hell of a job. You know, it's not that many radical media spots that are still like kicking ass and doing their thing, you know. So I appreciate you all for always being on the forefront of all types of liberation movements, black and brown, and even the comrades in Europe shutting down. It's invigorating and we need it. So thank you.
Drive you crazy if you allow it. Fuck it, I gots to live.
first topic we're going to discuss is this, you know, crowdfunded build the wall thing, which has apparently built half a mile worth of wall so far.
Something like that. So just quick background. I don't know how much people remember about this, but around the government shutdown, so January-ish, which feels like it was 600 years ago. But in January, this dude named Brian Colfage, who is known pretty widely amongst people that pay attention to, like, scammers and grifters on the far right, opened up a GoFundMe page to raise $1 billion to build the border wall. And the original idea was that he was going to, like, donate the money to the government, but then people told him that you can't do that. So then they just kept it. And they raised some amount of money in the millions of dollars, very depressingly. And we're kind of sitting on it for a long time. So over that period of time, as Brian Colfage's reputation kind of got exposed for what it was in the wider public because of the publicity around this thing, he decided to kind of bring in other people, including Chris Kobach, who used to be the governor of Kansas and then ended up as the dude who ran Donald Trump's presidential committee to investigate the, like, bogus voter fraud stuff at the beginning of the administration, and is now just kind of a figure on the far right. He also has connections to FAIR, which I know we mentioned a few episodes ago. So he's essentially the spokesperson for this project. Where the project stands now is they're building part of a wall on private land, and pretty typical of this crew of people and their complete lack of any kind of preparation, they forgot to get building permits approved. So construction is now officially shut down as of this morning.
But wasn't the deal like the guy stole a bunch of the money or there was some, like, mismanagement of funds?
There's a bunch of stuff with Brian Colfage. But so the reason people originally think he's shady is he used to run a bunch of, like, very intentionally fake news, like Facebook news pages. And what he would do is he would buy up other fake news pages and, like, use them to drive traffic towards his. And he was making, like, tons and tons of money on just advertising dollars on Facebook. And people kept reporting him to Facebook. And Facebook kept refusing to do anything about it until a couple of the former reporters from his outlets, which there were, I think, like 150 of them or something, started coming out with stories about how with, you know, emails and all kinds of stuff that they were leaking to the press about how this guy was telling them to write fake stories that would drive traffic, knowing that they were fake, knowing that the implications of them would be potentially socially horrendous, and being incredibly abusive to his employees when they pushed back on that. During this whole thing, he definitely did, I forget the specifics of the story, definitely did take some money. But he's still involved in the project. So it's like, I'm not entirely sure where that all landed, and whether he gave it back or not. But the dude's super shady. A lot of people refuse to believe he was super shady because he's, like, I think he's a triple amputee war veteran. So he got blown up in an IUD attack, or IED attack. And lost an arm in two lakes. And so he's, like, wheelchair bound. And so a lot of people were hesitant to call this dude out for being super shady, but essentially he's just a really big scammer. And is kind of the guy who started this whole thing. So yeah, that's kind of where that lives now. It's a comedy of errors is what it is. Comedy of errors.
So it stopped then the construction. Cause I mean, there's goal is that they want to connect like another piece of the fence and they want to build about 20 miles worth of fence and then, you know, connect those two.
Yeah, I think they have on this one patch of land in Texas, they have the ability to build 3 miles. They don't have 20 concurrent miles of land to build on.
Well, then how the hell are they going to build it?
Good question.
Steve Bannon going to get out there and grease his little warts up and get in the dirt and start building?
I mean, maybe. Like, the reality of this whole project is that it started as a scam, and then when it was called out for being a scam and people started threatening to sue the dude, he was like, no, this isn't a scam. See, Chris Kobach is involved now. Right?
Oh, you know it's legit. The guy that steals millions of votes is involved. Oh.
Yeah. That guy. So, but on the right wing, you gotta remember Chris Kobach is kind of a hero. people approach him as like a guy who stood up to the system and blah, blah, blah. And he's stopping all the undocumented people from voting and all that crap, right? Like, he is a hero on the far right. Now, of course, he's a hero because, again, the ability of the far right to use media to manipulate narratives of the present, and to very selectively give out certain information or just straight manufacture random crap, in order to try and encourage people to buy into their narratives, right? And the right wing has a very long history of this. I mean, the authoritarian left does too, and we'll talk about that a little bit later, but, Chris Kobach is a creature of the right wing media sphere almost entirely. And so he's become a hero. He's a celebrity in that world. And so being involved, that of course makes it not a scam, right? Obviously.
What I think is funny about the wall thing is that it's moved beyond, you know, what's like happening in reality. Like, it's not about the fact that like the wall isn't being built. Doesn't look like it's going to be finished anytime soon. Like, no. That's not what matters. It's just, and in fact, like, it's never mattered the, you know, like what it actually does. It's just the physical representation of, you know, either white supremacy or like national sovereignty in the form of like border division, like physically encased in infrastructure.
It's all of those things. I mean, I think even more than that, for a lot of Trump supporters, it was simultaneously a sort of social indicator, right? Like a social signaling exercise. About kind of norms, like transgressing norms of politeness in public conversation and being comfortable doing that, right? Gotta keep in mind a lot of the right wing, especially like white people on the right wing and Christians, exist in a universe that's typified by persecution complex. And so whenever they're going out and saying build the wall, that's obviously, you know, and of course I'm being incredibly sarcastic here, but that's obviously a group of people that's being repressed, demanding their own protection, right? Obviously. That's what it signaled. I mean, there was this kind of way that that slogan built solidarity amongst Trump supporters, which, you know, is a really interesting thing to study. There's a way that it marked groups of people, right, who was able to be inside the country and who was able to be outside the country. That had more symbolism than just the actual physical building of the wall. And it sort of stood as this, like, symbol of a great national works self-defense project, right? Because, again, in Trumpverse, in the Trump universe, right, people approach the current situation as if the United States is constantly under siege by its enemies, right? That we're totally under assault all the time. And that the only way to protect ourselves is by building really big, really thick walls, right? And so the wall kind of symbolizes an incredibly paranoid worldview, and marks people that agree with that incredibly paranoid worldview. So it's not super surprising someone like Chris Kobach gets involved in something like this, because he himself is a remarkably paranoid person about all manner of things, and probably more of a white nationalist than he lets on.
Well, I mean, it's just interesting that like somebody like Steve Bannon wants to, like, you know, tie themselves to this, because I mean, it could totally fail and not go anywhere.
Yeah, but if you think about it, like, why does Bannon tie himself to anything?
Right.
It's sure. Not about the project succeeding. He's too smart for that, right? I mean, like, I say this all the time, but it's true. Like, Steve Bannon's a very intelligent person. He's not an idiot, and he's not reckless. Like, he knows exactly what he's doing every step of the way, and he has his reasons for that. So why would Bannon jump on this bandwagon? Because obviously the project isn't going to succeed, right? Like, they still have 17 miles of land they're trying to get permission to build on, somewhere on the southern border. Most towns aren't going to grant them building permits for it, because the reality is that a lot of people who live on the border don't want a border wall there. Like, they don't want to live in a militarized zone. Like, of course they don't. That's pretty basic. You know, so why would Steve Bannon kind of attach himself to this? It's because of what we were just talking about. Like, the wall isn't about building the wall. The wall is about being able to leverage essentially racism in kind of populist political tactics, right? To be able to say, look, here's this group of people, you are now a part of us. And us are threatened by these other things over here that we need to exclude ourselves from having any kind of connection to. It's not even that that exclusion will ever work. It's that the exclusion and the failure of the exclusion will actually create the political inertia that Bannon's looking for, right? If the wall were actually to be built, my guess is that Trumpism would come to an end as a political tendency faster than if the wall isn't built.
Why do you think that?
Because Trumpism can exist without Trump. And so if Trump goes down because he failed on his one campaign promise, all that's going to mean is that his supporters, who now feel solidarity with each other, are going to be even more motivated to go or to go with whoever the person who picks up that mantle is going to be. And you see this in Europe a lot. There's a similar dynamic that goes on. Like, right-wing parties are only able to succeed in Europe because the flow of refugees into countries inside the EU hasn't slowed down. If that flow were to ever slow down, they would lose their talking point. Their one and only talking point. And parties like the UK Independence Party, or the Northern League in Italy, or, you know, the Brothers of Italy, right, which is Mario Salvini's party, they would never be able to gain the support that they have now, right? The Golden Dawn in Greece did the same thing with the financial crisis. They went, look at this financial crisis, it's so awful. And the second that austerity measures were put into place, and the second that the economy kind of stabilized a bit, the Golden Dawn support dropped immediately. And left-wing parties started picking up support, largely because of the effects of the austerity programs. But it was no longer this, like, live-or-die crisis, look at Europe victimizing us, right? Which was the Golden Dawn's kind of campaign slogan, right? Look at Europe. We need to break away from Europe because all they're trying to do is extract wealth out of us. They already screwed us once. Now they're trying to do it again, right? Once that all stabilized itself out, Golden Dawn lost a lot of support because it couldn't leverage that line anymore. And I think you see the same thing with immigration in Europe. I think you would see the same thing with the wall. That if the wall were to ever be built, that eliminates the one and only talking point of Trumpism. The one thing that created solidarity amongst Trump supporters, the symbol of that solidarity, would all of a sudden not be a thing that they demobilize to advocate for. It'd be a thing that exists and would be predictably ineffective at achieving the goal that they're trying to achieve. It would eliminate all of the sort of rhetorical force that the idea of the wall has if it were to ever be physically manifested. Now, that doesn't mean Trump doesn't want to build the wall. I think he absolutely does. But Trump's also an idiot and isn't a political strategist. I think Steve Bannon doesn't particularly want the wall to be finished. I think he wants the wall to stay an idea and a possibility because he can gain politically from that.
And they can always say, like, oh, those damn Democrats keeping us from our wall.
Yep. He can still leverage that, and he will over and over and over again. That once the wall is built, I mean, again, go back to the Trump rhetoric here. When the wall is built, immigration is solved, right? That was the way that they portrayed it. You build the wall, you solve immigration. So if you solve immigration, you can't leverage racist perspectives on immigration to gain electoral advantage. You can't do it anymore. And so in a certain way, the right wing, especially right now, depends on these crises that they themselves are also creating. Right. And it's why Trump creates a border crisis. Right. Because there's a humanitarian crisis. There's a refugee crisis. There's, you know, any number of other things going on. What there is not is a crisis in crime levels born out of undocumented immigration. That just straight up does not exist. But they had to create it in order to reinforce a narrative that they started around the wall in order to maintain that dynamic of being able to gain political support. It's a very Bannonist kind of way of doing things, where you manufacture a crisis and then leverage it, but you make sure it never gets solved. It's the same thing he's trying to do with the European Union right now, where if the European Union were to dissolve, Bannon's entire project of uniting the far right in Europe is over. There's no more leverage to force parties to work together. It's all done.
All right, well, let's continue forward with other news. What else is going on here?
Yeah, so there's two huge news stories that happened in the last couple of days revolving around the Department of Justice. The first being, and this happened earlier, later last week, slash through the weekend into the beginning of this week, Donald Trump decided through executive edicts, essentially, to grant William Barr, the attorney general, the sole right to declassify any documents he chooses in relation to the Russia investigation. Now, on the surface, that sounds like a potentially good thing, right? He's allowing someone to declassify documents. They're going to be able to get out into the public. You know, if William Barr is the, you know, legalist attorney that he portrays himself to be, then, you know, maybe we'll see things of legal consequences and so on. But the reality is that what we've seen so far from William Barr is that he is very good at leveraging legal language and the appearance of legalism in order to manipulate information to shape perspectives on the present. And the most glaring example we have of that is obviously the summary of and then press conference that he did in relation to the Mueller report. And I'll get into some of the blowback from that in relation to the Mueller team's own comments in relation to that summary in a little bit. But what Barr did in those circumstances was he took a document, a 450-page long document that he knew most people were not going to read in its entirety because it's really long. I still am only two-thirds of the way through it, and I read a lot. It's really long, and it's really detailed. There's no fluff in that document at all. It's very detailed. So he took this document under the assumption that most people weren't going to read it and issued a summary which essentially said Donald Trump did nothing wrong. Now, if you read the report, that's not what the report says at all. The report is pretty definitive on the idea, and this starts in the introduction and works its way all the way through the body of the report. They're very definitive about the concept that they are not saying that nothing illegal happened. They are only saying that they were told not to prosecute it, right? But that there is evidence. And they repeat that numerous times in the report. So Barr was very clearly intentionally misleading people as the attorney general. Now, what's important about that is that we have to keep in mind that the attorney general is not the attorney for the executive branch, right? The White House has its own White House counsel for that and its own attorneys and private attorneys. There's a lot of attorneys that look out for the legal interests of the executive branch. The Department of Justice is not supposed to operate that way. Now, they have. This is something that happened under the Nixon administration when multiple attorney generals resigned so they wouldn't have to fire Archibald Cox, the independent prosecutor, and Robert Bork, who ended up getting appointed to a federal judgeship afterwards for this, was willing to do that. And that is a clear indication of the Justice Department being used for political reasons by the executive branch to protect the executive branch. There are other examples of this, but generally throughout American history, the Department of Justice is supposed to operate relatively independently. They're supposed to be grounded in a law enforcement mentality and an investigatory mentality, right? So like the FBI, their job is to investigate federal crimes that happen domestically, right? That mandate has changed, but that's the original mandate. And to, of course, like attack any radicals in the United States with, you know, merciless force, which is also part of their original mandate. So anyways, what Barr was given all of a sudden was Barr was given the unilateral ability to declassify whatever documents he deems relevant, quote unquote, relevant. So the concern here is there's a myriad of concerns that have been articulated, and I want to go through them, but hone in on the one that I actually care about. The first concern is actually from the intelligence community. So the CIA, Gina Haspel, the NSA, Dan Coats, the director of national intelligence, and Christopher Wray, the director of the FBI, have all come out and said, we think that this is a terrible idea. A lot of this information is classified for a reason, and there's like sources that would be revealed if any of this information were to get out, either directly or through implication, right? And the intelligence agency was trying to make the argument as to why documents are classified. Now, someone myself who, you know, really doesn't like government, and particularly really doesn't like the idea that information is being hidden from us through the classification process, which is Byzantine and kind of hidden and impossible to navigate. The argument that's being made by the intelligence agencies makes me incredibly uneasy because they're essentially arguing for their ability to continue to hide information in the interest of more or less American hegemony, right? However, there's another argument that's being constructed, which around this discussion, which I think is relevant. And that argument is coming from legal scholars, mostly. And what they're saying is that traditionally the declassification process has had to involve some level of being able to prove public interest. It also involves some level of, you know, being able to demonstrate that releasing a document would be in the interest of the accuracy of a public conversation. And those are usually the kind of metrics that are utilized to determine the value of a document and whether or not that document needs to be released. What is going on here, though, is that for the first time ever since document classification has become a thing, an individual person who is not the president has been given the power to declassify whatever document they want. And that person is a person that we know now has a bit of a history in manipulating information in order to shape narratives to the liking of the executive branch. William Barr also has some other relatively strange tendencies to fall into certain conspiracy theories. This is something that wasn't brought up during his confirmation very much. But he, for example, has been a proponent ever since the beginning of the Trump administration of the theory that the deep state is out to destroy Donald Trump. And he has articulated this idea on mic a number of times since Trump has gotten into office and at least once since he's become attorney general. That's pretty concerning.
And who is the deep state according to him?
Everybody, right? Like, so the deep state,
somehow they were unable to stop him from becoming president, but they're going to remove him from office. It's a funny thing, this deep state.
Yeah, the deep state is simultaneously all powerful and entirely incapable of achieving any of its objectives. Yeah. So the deep state, for those of you that are not initiated into the weirdness of internet conspiracy theory, is the idea that hidden inside of government agencies, there are people, and we've, you know, some of this is rooted in reality, right? Like, we talked about this.
Right. I mean, they ruined a good term. I mean, you know, the term originally was just like basically power that was, you know, resting with inside institutions that, you know, was outside of the reach of so-called, you know, democratic oversight or, you know, even just like voting cycles, like, you know, military officials that have been there for years. I mean, the Pentagon would be a classic example of, you know, the deep state.
Yeah, NSA, Geospatial Intelligence Agency. Right. I mean, there's a lot of these intelligence agencies most people have never even heard of, let alone have information about, right?
Which is funny because when, like, if you look at, like, a lot of the alt-right memes and stuff, when you see them talk about drain the swamp, generally they're talking about, you know, career politicians that have been, you know, voted into office. It's again like these faces of quote unquote, you know, electoral democracy, people that have been voted into office, but they don't really talk about, you know, the real power behind the scenes, which is like people that, you know, are not voted into office, you know, people that are there, you know, military representing, you know, huge, you know, industrial complexes, things like that.
Yeah, government bureaucrats. I mean, and this is rooted in some reality. I mean, we talked about leave behinds from administrations a few episodes ago, right? Like, that's a very real thing. There are factions inside, like, the State Department or the DOJ that were brought in under past administrations that are still trying to implement their worldview through departmental policy. Like, that's a real thing, right? It's always been a issue/reality inside the United States. However, what's meant by that term in this case is that, according to people that are an advocate of this theory, and this spans the gamut from anti-Semitic neo-Nazi conspiracy theories all the way to like
QAnon,
right? Yeah, and like everything in between. Essentially, the argument is that there is a cabal of people deep inside of the military and intelligence agencies whose goal is to secretly control the U.S. government, and that Donald Trump was the one person that was going to stop them. So they need to stop Donald Trump. It's absurd. It's completely absurd.
And again, they somehow did not have the power to keep him from being voted into office. But yet, in the middle of his presidency, they're going to like launch a coup and throw him into a Pizzagate pedophile ring or something.
According to these same people, the deep state also assassinated JFK. So, like, apparently Trump was also immune to assassination attempts by the deep state. Who would have known? But yeah, I mean, in this worldview, Donald Trump, a man who had to have his father donate money to universities to let him in, a man who has been hiding his grades ever since he graduated from business school.
That's his lawyer.
Lies about his net worth. A man who was the least successful business person between the mid-80s and mid-90s.
Has his lawyer threaten schools because he doesn't want his grades released.
That guy, the guy who can't pronounce the word origin, that guy is supposed to be the guy that was supposed to tear the deep state to shreds. That guy. And so, of course, the deep state is out to get Donald Trump. And what is the most absurd part about the story is that the attorney general, the most powerful cop in the country, is an advocate for this theory. And now this is the guy who has the ability to declassify any document he chooses. So what's important about this, as far as I'm concerned, is not that he's declassifying documents. That's not what's relevant. What is relevant is how he chooses what documents to declassify and why he's making those decisions. Because if there's one thing that I think a lot of us have learned as we've sort of tried to parse out ideas of media literacy in the 21st century, in an era where anyone can say anything on the internet, the ability to determine an accurate narrative from an inaccurate narrative is very difficult. And one of the things that tends to support an argument very clearly are documents, right? The Intercept, for example, has made this into an art form that they will go look at this private intelligence company spying on protesters at Standing Rock. And that all sounds very fanciful, but look at these documents. We have to prove that it's happening, right? Like, people like Jeremy Scahill and Glenn Greenwald have really taken this kind of journalism to an art form, and have done it very well. What the right wing does, though, is they sort of mimic the form of this kind of journalism while manipulating the content of this kind of journalism. And that appears in a number of different guises. So just this past week, there was a video of Nancy Pelosi that was very selectively cut to try and demonstrate that she was like mentally unstable or physically unhealthy or something like that. They did the same thing with Hillary Clinton. There have been examples of fake documents that have been used in right-wing media. So they're mimicking the form without being able to mimic the actual accuracy, because actual documents tend to not support right-wing arguments very well. What is dangerous about this? What is specifically incredibly dangerous about this is that by allowing William Barr to leverage documents in a selective way, we're giving him greater power to manipulate our understandings of the present, right? So it's one thing for Donald Trump to scream on Twitter that there was no collusion or that there was no obstruction or whatever. It's another thing for the attorney general to selectively choose documents to manipulate public perception to support that conclusion. At which point, not only is William Barr risking his own legitimacy, which is already being called very much into question, but we're risking this sliding further down this process in which all of a sudden it's impossible to ground an argument in anything, right? That the tactic of muddying the waters has become so all pervasive that there's nothing that we can leverage anymore except document leaks to prove points. what is really dangerous about this is that by doing this, we are risking a reality in which document leaks themselves become discredited. Because now all of a sudden it's coming from the Department of Justice. And that is a very dangerous reality on a discursive level when we're talking about how to decide whether we believe something or don't believe something, or whether a conclusion is valid or invalid. One of the few things we can rely on are documents, and this threatens to undermine all of that. And so for the sake of discourse, I really hope that this doesn't actually happen, but it looks like it will. And that's going to complicate our landscape, political landscape, much more dramatically than potentially even other things that have gotten a lot more press coverage in this. Like, this is a much more important story than people gave it credit for.
Right. Well, let's move on to the real juicy details of this week, is that Mueller finally had enough, gave everyone the finger, and said, screw you, I'm leaving. I mean, again, not that Mueller is like, I mean, I don't want to make Mueller into some like stupid meme the Democrats have where he's got his shirt off and he's hella buff and like Trump is running from him. But again, you know, what does it mean that he quit today? And I mean, he quit and he basically said, like, look, all the crap that the Republicans have been talking about, you know, this thing I just spent the past 2 years on is BS. Like, they're misrepresenting this.
Yes.
So, but what does this all mean? I mean, is this going to amount to anything?
Yeah, well, so that's what we'll find out tomorrow. But essentially what happened today is that, unbeknownst to a lot of people, Robert Mueller still worked at the Department of Justice. Right? I think there was this kind of perception that the investigation was over, and so he just left, right? Which makes sense. But in reality, like, after an investigation like this, there's tons of cleanup that's going on. For example, Roger Stone has a political associate who was suing the special prosecutor's office over a grand jury subpoena. And because, of course, he's a rich white guy, he gets to not be in jail while he, you know, tries to file an injunction against his grand jury subpoena. Unlike Chelsea Manning, who filed an injunction against her grand jury subpoena, but had to do it from a prison cell, because she first had to refuse to testify. But when you're rich and white and a dude, and have good lawyers, you don't have to go to jail first. You just get to hang out at home or whatever. Anyways, that guy dropped his lawsuit today, and is now going to testify in front of the same grand jury, except now the grand jury is being run by the district court in Washington, D.C., right? So one of the things that happens in these situations is that these special prosecutor's offices, they accumulate a bunch of data. They accumulate a bunch of potential charges that aren't resolved yet, and they farm those out to other federal district courts, right? We've talked a little bit on the show about how, like, some of those get farmed out to federal district court in New York, in Manhattan, especially if they have to do with financial crimes. Some of them are getting sent to federal district court in Northern Virginia, especially if they have to do with, like, any sort of political crimes, electoral law crimes, things like that. There are apparently even other cases, which were unknown as of today, that are being sent to DC Circuit, which is something that wasn't known. It's also unclear what that grand jury is even about, at this point. But anyways, apparently Mueller and people on his team were hanging around getting evidence out to district courts and archiving things and essentially cleaning up, you know, like, there are lots of pizza boxes to throw out and stuff when you write a 400-page report and things like that. And today he decided, without announcing it to anybody beforehand, essentially, that he was quitting. He's done. And there wasn't like a, I'm going to resign in 2 weeks, like you usually get in government. It's, I'm resigning right now. I'm leaving at the end of the day. The best part about this is the Department of Justice didn't even know that he was going to throw a press conference about this until this morning. The White House heard about it last night. And the press corps that usually hangs around the Department of Justice heard about it like 2 hours before the press conference happened. So that's relevant, and I'll get to that in a second. But essentially, quick summary, Mueller gets up there. And Robert Mueller is a man who doesn't talk a lot, generally, very rarely talks in public. He barely talked in public when he was the director of the FBI. At a time where there were a lot of high-profile terrorism arrests, you never saw Robert Mueller at a press conference, maybe once or twice. But he's not like a public figure, right? That's not how he views himself. And so for him to do a press conference at all, was very surprising. For him to do a press conference where he essentially gets up and for 8 minutes says, again, this is an official Department of Justice press conference, says, I'm quitting. How did he put it? He said, if we didn't have evidence that a crime had been committed, we would have said so. And that the reason that we didn't file any indictments around the evidence that we did have was because of a Department of Justice regulation that originated in the Nixon administration that says that at least temporarily, sitting presidents have immunity from Department of Justice prosecution. Right? Now, there's no law that says that. It's just Department of Justice legal guidance. And that was reaffirmed under Bill Clinton and then reaffirmed again under Jeff Sessions when he was attorney general under Trump. And then he essentially says, I'm not going to take any questions. I will only testify in front of Congress about things related to the report. Peace, mic drop, and then walked out of the room. And that was it. 8 minutes. And in those 8 minutes, he essentially blew up the entire Department of Justice's attempt to manipulate what happened in the report through William Barr's summary of the report. He essentially more or less implied that Barr had, in the most generous interpretation, severely misrepresented facts in order to support a White House narrative. And in a less generous interpretation, outright lied about relevant legal matters to the American public. He essentially more or less just straight out came out and said that. And then followed that with, if any legal action is to be taken, that is now in the hands of Congress. Wink, wink, maybe an impeachment proceeding should start. Right? So, that all happened. So there's relevant parts in, so the way he did this was really fascinating. Usually, when you have a press conference at the Department of Justice, you kind of tell people first. Whenever government people talk to the press, there's a huge approval process about what you can say and what you can't say and so on, so on, so on. Usually in the Department of Justice, historically, that's a very rigid process and you don't just call a press conference randomly. There's one other instance where I can remember that happening inside the Department of Justice, and that was James Comey's press conference right before the election, where he announced that they had found new emails related to the Hillary Clinton email investigation, and that they hadn't actually cleared her legally, right? The, you know, press conference that Democrats claimed doomed Hillary Clinton's political campaign, when in reality it was just bad campaigning and a bad candidate. But that was the only other time I can remember where an almost unannounced DOJ press conference happened. So for Mueller to do it that way, what that indicates is that essentially he was worried that people were going to get in his way, that they were going to try and stop him from doing this, and he didn't want that obstruction, so he just went for it and just called a press conference, which is not only completely out of character for the Department of Justice, it's even more out of character for Robert Mueller, who doesn't like talking to people in public and definitely always follows rules. So that part's fascinating. The other part that's fascinating is the fallout from this. So this press conference happened, you know, sort of middle of the afternoon-ish. There wasn't any warning, so it's not like there were, you know, CNN newsrooms queued up to, like, carry the thing live and all this other stuff, although they did carry it live at the last minute. But there weren't, like, analyst pools set up for all this stuff. But essentially what ends up happening is after this press conference, one by one, senators and congresspeople start coming out in favor of starting impeachment proceedings. So the big one was Cory Booker today, came out and started saying, well, I mean, I guess that this is what we have to do. Nancy Pelosi even hinted that, you know, she'll wait to see how things play out. Gerald Nadler, who's the head of the House Judiciary Committee, who is like a Pelosi ally, also came out and said, well, you know, we're going to have to look into this a little bit more, but if we're to take Robert Mueller's word for this, there definitely might be grounds to start looking into impeachment. Even Justin Amash is a Republican from Michigan, who skews towards a kind of libertarian wing of the Republican Party. He came out in favor of impeachment, I think like a week or so ago. But today
he's gotten a lot of crap for that.
What's up? Oh, yeah. He's still getting a lot of crap for that. But he came out very, very strongly today and essentially demanded that impeachment proceedings begin. Also, one after another, the kind of mishmash of random, like, minor Democratic presidential candidates all came out in favor of impeachment today. And that's a pretty big swing. And the reason that's relevant is that there's this debate going on in the Democratic Party right now about how to approach the concept of impeachment, right? And there's sort of, what I would argue, kind of three schools of thought about this. The first school of thought is, we absolutely should impeach Trump because he's an asshole, and that's what our base wants, right? Which may be the case. It's kind of hard to say whether your average Democrat really wants to pursue impeachment at this point, or whether they're too disillusioned to even think about that as a reality. But there is definitely a significant constituency amongst the Democratic Party base that is super pro-impeachment. And so there are definitely people from, you know, heavily Democratic areas like the Northeast, even areas of the Rust Belt, like major cities in the Rust Belt, as well as the West Coast, that are starting to make the argument that impeachment is a thing that you have to do. So that's one wing. The second wing of this debate are people that kind of fall into a middle position. And their argument is, look, if we start impeachment proceedings, if we start a committee to investigate possible impeachment, we gain all these extra subpoena powers. We gain a bunch of legal powers. It's a lot harder to overturn our subpoenas because now this is technically a criminal investigation. You know, we gain a lot more power to gain information from Donald Trump. And those people in that school of thought aren't necessarily even arguing that you go forward with impeachment. They're just arguing that you leverage the possibility of impeachment to gain power to do other investigations about other things, right? Now, that school of thought is losing ground a lot in the last couple of weeks, largely because, excuse me, the Trump administration's attempts to suppress subpoenas and to suppress document requests keep getting shot down in the court. So there's not really a ton of impetus to leverage congressional process in order to gain the ability to have extra subpoena power, because as of right now, the federal court system seems to be more or less agreeing with the idea that Congress already has that power, and that they don't actually need any additional powers to do any of the things that they're already trying to do. So that school of thought really isn't gaining a lot of ground and is probably losing a lot of ground now. Then you've got the Pelosi school of thought. And this school of thought is really interesting because what is being argued by moderates in the Democratic Party right now? Is a strategy point. And what they're saying is, look, impeachment takes a long time. And the election's coming up soon. And if they file articles of impeachment, not only is that going to make the 2020 election about impeachment, and therefore about the Russia investigation, which is an area that Trump has more of a foothold into his base than others, right? But also that the Democrats want to run on ideas of the future. And you see this with people like Elizabeth Warren throwing out a new policy proposal every day, almost. People like Kamala Harris doing the same thing. Joe Biden really has been campaigning on rhetoric only and hasn't really said much about anything that he wants to do. But the candidate running right next to Biden is Bernie Sanders, who is a policy candidate, right? And so the Democrats really do want to run on policy, and they're concerned that if they try and impeach Trump now, that will detract attention away from the policy discussion, which they think that they have every ability to win. So the problem with that approach is what I would consider to be pretty basic, which is most people don't care about policy. If you actually ask people that voted for Donald Trump what his policies were, and there were a lot of kind of TV specials as well as academic studies on this, if you ask Trump supporters what his policy proposals were in 2016, they couldn't tell you. They could tell you about the wall, and they tell you about, you know, tax cuts and stuff like that, but they didn't really have an idea of what was going to be in the tax bill because Trump never really talked about it specifically. There was no discussion about what immigration policy was going to look like because it pretty much boiled down to build the wall, right? Like three-word slogans. the Democrats want to run a policy-centric campaign. But the basic reality is that your average American adult only reads somewhere between 6 and 10 pages of text a day, including at work, and 6 to 10 pages of reading a day is not enough to understand policy, right? It's just not, when Elizabeth Warren is writing 80-page policy papers about everything. But what they're concerned about is that by going for impeachment, that's going to detract attention away from policy. So what we're really left with now is a world in which you have pro-impeachment Democrats and anti-impeachment Democrats, right? And those anti-impeachment Democrats today start softening their stance a lot. So Pelosi, who was dead set against impeachment 2 weeks ago, starting to be like, well, I mean, maybe we might want to start looking into this. And that's not because she actually believes in impeachment as a process or a strategy. It's that she thinks that the base does. That the base of the Democratic Party, especially today, is really riled up about impeachment stuff. And so this press conference, though it was only 8 minutes long, could actually have a pretty profound effect as far as determining what's going to happen in the next month or so. Because if the Democrats do decide to show up on Monday and file articles of impeachment, or show up on Monday and create a committee to investigate articles of impeachment, that changes the game pretty significantly, I think. It's very likely that, you know, Trump has been essentially daring them to do this because he thinks he can win this argument if it becomes an impeachment argument, which I think is delusional, but he believes it. So that's all that matters, really, in this administration. But that will change everything as far as what's going on right now. Trump will have his story that will be the universal distraction from everything else he wants to do. And the entire landscape will change if that happens. So this press conference could be the turning point as far as what's going to go down for the next like year and a half, as far as political discourse and policy goes. So, yeah, everyone should be paying a lot of attention to what goes on with this discussion right now, because Justin Amash showed up at a town hall meeting this evening in Michigan and said, hey, maybe it's time to start impeachment proceedings. And got a standing ovation in a Republican district in Michigan, right? A heavily Republican district in Michigan. That's a pretty interesting indicator to me that this discussion is changing pretty dramatically. The way that the Trump administration reacts when they realize that they're not going to win this discussion and impeachment proceedings have started, if that's what happens, is anyone's guess, but I assume it's going to involve firing a lot of people at the Department of Justice. Which is clearly obstruction in itself most of the time, or would be considered so. So we might be looking at a very different political reality today, especially because people trust Robert Mueller for better or worse, right? Even though he used to be director of the FBI, and we have no reason we should ever trust him, but a lot of people do.
And again, we've said this multiple times, but I mean, they're not going to impeach him. They don't want to.
No, they absolutely don't. And nor do I think that that's what we should be hoping for, right? Yeah, I'd get rid of Trump faster, sure. But it doesn't change any of the dynamics of how politics works in the United States. All that happens is that the Democrats can now claim that we've returned to normality, and that has this depressing effect in relation to any grassroots resistance, because now everything's back to normal, right? It's all fine. It's cool.
It will be interesting to see how Trump deals with just Mueller, you know, doing this stuff, like what crazy crap he's going to say about it.
Check his Twitter account. It's been interesting. Essentially, the line coming out of the White House today is Mueller confirmed everything we've been saying. Which is
not you can't quit. Happened. You're fired.
Yeah, I mean, it's not in any way what happened. Like, Sarah Huckabee Sanders had a statement for the press a half an hour after the press conference was over, after very clearly not listening to anything that was said, and all she said was, look at this one out-of-context quote, that means that he exonerated Donald Trump. And that's a line that's been getting repeated by everybody, with, again, the notable exception of Steve Bannon, who Steve Bannon was interviewed about this. I forget where. I kind of caught it in the flurry of articles I was reading about this. But his response was, oh, this is absolutely disastrous. Because Steve Bannon's not an idiot. And he knows what just happened. You know, what he saw is Trump's entire narrative around the Mueller investigation just imploded today. Because Robert Mueller himself, a person that a lot of Americans trust more than William Barr, came out and said that William Barr had just deceived everybody. And, you know, the Washington Post's response was, cool, dude, that would have been nice like a month ago. Totally wish you would have said that like a month ago. Right? But, yeah, I mean, the White House's official response is, well, you know, he's just repeating everything we've been saying. It's all good. No collusion, exclamation point. And then Donald Trump, of course, ended that with thank you, exclamation point, you know, because you have to throw an exclamation point at the end of that. But anyways, I mean, that's not what we should be hoping for, right? I mean, if we're serious about the whole revolution thing as a concept, right, the change that we should be looking for, the political dynamics we should be looking for are not that a bunch of powerful people in Congress decide to impeach another powerful person. That doesn't actually, we don't gain anything out of that. We get rid of one asshole, right? But the reality is that Donald Trump is a product of the entire history of American racism, the contemporary history of American capitalism, bank fraud, deregulation, right? Like the media landscape, reality television. Like Donald Trump, more than anybody else, is a reflection of the ugliest parts of the American psyche, right? And that's not going away just because he does, right? Nothing really fundamentally changes just because Donald Trump is not in office anymore. There are still people claiming sovereignty to determine how we're supposed to live our lives with police force. The same social dynamics that allowed him to get into office in the first place are still in place. Impeaching him doesn't change any of that. And that's why when we're looking at this, I think what we need to look at is more, how does this kind of theorizing or looking at the edges of a political crisis allow us to understand the dynamics of what's going on internally, right? So this impeachment debate, as and especially today, has torn open a lot of the divisions inside the Democratic Party. And this fight is going to get pretty brutal internally. And people really need to be paying attention to that, because I think that there are some pretty dramatic shifts going on inside the Democratic Party right now. And there is a group of people who, you know, are more moderate, who have been in control of the party ever since Clinton, who don't really want to relinquish that control anytime soon, partially because they make a lot of money being in charge, and partially because they have a lot of power being in charge, that they could lose all of that if they lose this fight over impeachment. And so when we're looking at what's going on right now, we have to see this not just on the level of impeachment, but we need to think about this on the level of what are the dynamics surrounding this discussion and what are the dynamics surrounding this entire scenario, right, around impeachment, and what can this discussion really tell us about what's going on and what are the points of intervention in this moment right now? Because that's always the question we have to be asking ourselves. It's not, you know, can we insider baseball game this thing, but it's more the question of how do we look at these moments in their specificity to start to understand what the most effective points of intervention are going to be when they do emerge. Because without a full understanding of our context, and moments like this can help us gain that understanding more so than we had before, we can never answer that question. And if we can't answer that question, we've got no business trying to do what we're doing right now.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us and follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.